Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn more about one of the most unusual conceptual artists of the past 30 years who has been called by a few art critics as the first great artist of the 21st century, which is no small irony as he died as the last century ended. Mark Lombardi is known today as the first artist to use metadata in a series of interlock designs, which connected money and power centers that transcended their diagram basis and became fine art drawings. Another irony is my guest today, journalist and author Patricia Goldstone, says that Lombardi couldn't draw. Nonetheless, Lombardi's huge drawing about the BCCI scandal, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which depicted the money laundering and financial crimes that took place at that institution, is now in the collection of the Whitney Museum. In fact, his other drawings about similar scandals are highly collectible today. When Lombardi had show openings, in fact, they were attended allegedly by federal officials who openly viewed these interlocks, apparently gleaning information his drawing showed, documenting how criminal money was infiltrating legitimate banking and other economic structures. So it's puzzling. In March 2000, Lombardi was on the cusp of major fame in the art world, and he apparently committed suicide. Apparently is the word, as Goldstone raises questions about his death, as well as describes how this art outsider seemed to have so much insider information about the intersection of power and money in her book, Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. It's published by Counterpoint Press. Patricia Goldstone joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Patricia Goldstone, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Rich.
This book, Interlock, delves deeply into the art and the associations of Mark Lombardi. Mark Lombardi, in certain circles in contemporary art, is very important, but he's sort of below the main radar of contemporary art. Explain who Mark Lombardi is.
Mark Lombardi was a conceptual artist, which essentially means he drew ideas instead of water lilies. Some people consider him to be the first great artist of the 21st century. He is unique in the art world because he used interlocks to create his art. And interlocks, for members of the audience who don't know what they are, and that's probably just about everyone, an interlock is a form of flowchart that's used to trace overly cozy relationships between boards of directors. Now, it's common in accounting and in litigation, but it's extremely unusual in art. In fact, it's totally unique. Mark used interlocks to draw a continual visual history of the interconnections between intelligence, organized crime, corporations, and governments in the shadow banking industry, which we've heard so much of since 2007. He was particularly interested in tracing things like money laundering and tax evasion. And he was way ahead of Edward Snowden and Julian Assange in releasing a very wide swath of extremely uncomfortable information to the public, visual WikiLeaks, as it were. He hung it on a wall for everyone to see. And what is also interesting and unique about him is that his own life is actually the missing strand in some of the shadowy visual narratives that make up his work. And needless to say, he died a very mysterious death.
Yes, he did. He was an apparent suicide in March of 2000. Now, what really makes this interesting, you're discussing events that really came to light within the last six, 7 years. A lot of this information sort of came out in lieu of the big recession and everything that came out in the late 2000s. He died in 2000. He was already putting this stuff into artwork, these documenting these relationships. How did he get this information?
Actually very systematic in the way that he worked. Because he couldn't draw, this is one of the surprising things about him, he conceptualized. And what he did was a form of visual narrative. He digested literally hundreds of books about the financial scandals of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, really going all the way back, in fact, to World War II. And he would digest these books down to bullet points of essential information about players and their connections, which he would index on thousands and thousands of 3x5 cards, which he carefully alphabetized. Part of his art was a form of library science, I suppose.
He was a research librarian at one point in his life,
at
correct?
At one point he was, that's quite correct. So when he started to draw, he would identify the main players by small circles in his drawings and arrange these players along timelines with dramatic arcing lines showing their linkages. Most of this was based on previously published information, with one important exception. And he ultimately noted his sources in between 14,000 and 40,000 3x5 cards. And that discrepancy is worth noting, because when I viewed the 14,000 cards archived at the Museum of Modern Art, all but four cards on the financial activities of the Bushes, on whom he focused much of his attention, were missing.
Really?
Yes.
Not there.
Well, you know, it was a very odd situation. I actually asked the chief archivist directly if they had archived the Bush material elsewhere, which is not uncommon, or if I had missed it. She couldn't answer that question. She referred me to the PR department instead.
And what did the PR department say?
Well, that's more or less where it ended.
Right. Well, do you think those cards disappeared, or what exactly? And what was the fascination with the Bush family? Obviously, the Bush family played a role in a lot of his artwork, whether it be documenting a future president, at least from Lombardi's point of view. He died in March of 2000. George W. Bush becomes president at the end of that year. And he's been documenting the Harkin energy deals that George W. Bush was involved in. He documented Iran-Contra, which involved then Vice President George H.W. Bush. And to some degree, depending on your political views and his persuasions. So what was the fascination with the Bush family?
Mark had actually had a personal run-in with the Bushes while he was living in Houston, which he did for 20 years. It's a note that I found in his files. Apparently, the Bushes were responsible for putting an end to his career as a curator. This is what he said in the note. And that's what prompted him to go down this path. But ultimately, the interesting thing about him is that he became pretty equal opportunity in his finger-pointing. He did focus a lot of attention on the Bushes, but he also did quite a number of important drawings about the Clintons and their links with the Lippo Group of Indonesia and the Riotti family, which were the source of accusations of Chinese influence peddling in the U.S. during Clinton's administration. Also, Mark Rich, who was famously connected to the Clintons, was one of the key middlemen that hooked Mark's drawings together, as was Jackson Stevens, who funded both the Bush and the Clinton campaigns. So, you know, in considering Mark, I think you have to recognize that he was really more like a social scientist than a political partisan, and that I believe his overwhelming interest was in getting this whole financial system of systems, which was so huge and so extensive, down on paper for everyone to see.
I think I've read, and maybe it was in your book or in another account, where Mark really started doing these interlocks, if you will, or metadata sort of structures. He called them narrative structures, not necessarily as a piece of art to begin with, but more of a sort of investigative notion of sort of trying to understand all these relationships.
That is a story that is in my book, and I don't believe it's been revealed elsewhere. Mark was actually recruited in the mid-80s by a very prominent Texas politician to utilize his skills, his drawing skills, in doing interlocks for an investigative salon, for lack of a better term, that she was conducting that was going into the subprime and oil-related scandals that were destroying the Texas economy at the time, and also delving into the Iran-Contra network, which was very heavily interlocked with the subprime scandals.
And that would be Texas politician Sissy Fahrenthold?
That's correct.
I guess she was feeding him a lot of this information that really wasn't out in the public view?
I don't think it was only Sissy Fahrenthold. The salon extended over a rather wide range of journalists and apparently also FBI people. And the person who really fed Mark the primary documents that I found in his files that surprised me greatly was a gentleman named Bill White, who sort of figures in the first few scenes of Robert Redford's new film, Truth.
You said, you know, all this information, with an important exception, was on these index cards? Were you referring to the fact that the Bush index cards have disappeared, or did you find other more confidential material in his personal effects?
I found a cache of documents, what a historian would call primary documents, mm-hmm. and that they were not previously published. Mark used to say to interviewers and critics that he felt safe because all of the work in his drawings came from previously published sources, but I actually found a stash of documents that were internal memos and other correspondence, including a very controversial trust agreement in his personal documents. Mm.
My guest today is Patricia Goldstone, a journalist who's written for Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, among others. She's written several books. She's also a playwright. Her latest book is titled Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. It's published by Counterpoint Press. And talking about this conceptual artist who died in March of 2000, who, if anything, his reputation is even greater today. These interlocks, we should sort of describe what these drawings are. These are huge drawings that go 3 foot, 4 foot, 5 foot long with these sort of arcing bubble points, sort of creating almost like a cloud-like structure. And every point is a name. It shows intersections of various names on a variety of issues. Probably the best-known one is his work on BCCI, which was, of course, the bank that had all these nefarious ties that went out of business in the 1990s. That's at the Whitney Museum. When did these interlocks sort of move into actual artworks, as opposed to sort of, again, this sort of narrative structure for him to understand this connection between power and money?
That's an interesting question, because Mark produced his first major body of work, about 10 of the monumental drawings, at white heat in a period of about 2 years between 1994 and 1996, while Senator John Kerry's investigating committee was working on BCCI. And what's fascinating about this body of drawings is that they line up with the questions that were, if you read the committee reports on BCCI, which I did, they line up with the questions that the committee said they lacked the time and the resources to investigate. I'm talking about things like the relationship between BCCI and Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, which was the money conduit for secretly arming Iraq against Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, and the relationship between BCCI and SNL bankster Charles Keating, for example.
Mm-hmm. So they follow along with the investigation. I want to get back to that question of when it became art again. How did these structures sort of become artwork? Was it part of an exhibit at the same time that this was going on?
Well, the drawings that I'm talking about became part of his first solo show in Houston.
Mm-hmm. Did they make a splash immediately, or was it only in hindsight did they become as important as they are considered in the art world today?
No, he got enough attention in Houston to make the move to New York.
Well, take us back to his beginnings. Mark grew up in upstate New York, was going to school. You mentioned in the book that he was terribly affected by the Kennedy assassination. He was a member of SDS during the late 60s and early 70s, and worked on an exhibit, which I wonder if this was a major influence for him. While he was, I guess, at Syracuse, I believe, he participated in an exhibit called From Teapot Dome to Watergate, and it took major pieces of art and sort of related them to political scandal over the 20th century. And he was the primary researcher for this, or one of the...
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Now, how do you think this had a major influence on sort of what would end up becoming his main artwork?
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, I think the seed was planted there. He found a way to come up with a huge idea, really. Yeah. And he took years cooking on it.
That particular exhibit, what was his role in it?
He was the researcher, and I believe he was one of the curators.
Uh-huh. So out of that experience, he went and was, I guess, a research librarian for a number of years. Was he trying other sorts of art before he came upon these interlocks?
He was, yes. He wasn't really a research librarian until a little later on. He moved down to Houston with his teacher and mentor, Jim Harrisis, who got a job running a very important museum there. And he initially was the curator for that museum. Then when he lost that job, he worked as a librarian for a while. But I think one of the surprising things about Mark is that he conceptualized because he wasn't really that technically facile. He couldn't paint.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't paint, couldn't draw, so he said, I have to be a conceptual artist, and he really wanted to be an artist at his heart.
Yes, and I think he was an artist. I don't think there's any doubt that he was, because he could apprehend an enormous amount of information all at once. He was very, very quick and intuitive about conceptualizing, and he was able to get at the big picture that lies beneath the surface of things. That's what computer scientists who still can't replicate what he did would call an aha experience. And I certainly had one when I looked at the monumental BCCI drawing, which links virtually every major scandal and bubble from the 1970s to the year 2000 to this vast underground economy. The aha experience is still unique to humans, particularly to artists, and it's one of the reasons why I find Mark's story, which is very dark in certain ways, ultimately quite life-affirming. He cannot be replaced by a computer.
Explain that. Have computer scientists tried to replicate sort of the work that he did to create all these relationships that show up in these interlocks?
Yes, they have, and they're still working on it.
Well, and of course, you share stories after his death and after September 11th. You all of a sudden see FBI men showing up at the Whitney saying, we want to look at, or showing up at show openings, looking at these interlocks. Do you think they were there gathering intelligence?
Well, only part of that story has been accessible. But what I discovered when I was researching the book was that the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Defense, and the Office of Naval Research all had to study his work in the wake of 9/11. Now, they were looking for clues to terrorist social networks, which Mark drew extensively, and also for traffic analysis tools, which is kind of a funny story, really, because even though the NSA, for example, is very good at collecting information on each and every one of us, they're not so good at analyzing it. So when they feed this massive information into a computer, the visualization that comes out is often a mess. In-house, it's called spaghetti. So what fascinated a lot of computer scientists about Mark's work was how the spacing in his drawings made them readable and directed the eye, as it were, to certain conclusions.
It's interesting. His narrative structures, as he called these interlocks, really is a strong narrative structure, apparently.
Yes, it's a consecutive narrative structure. I mean, Mark was fascinated by BCCI, which of course informed a lot of his work and is, in a certain sense, the genesis of it. And I don't know if everybody remembers BCCI, but it was a huge bank. It billed itself as the Bank of America for the Third World, but in fact it was the CIA's first global money laundry. Now, BCCI was connected to the subprime crises of the 1970s and 1980s and was officially closed down in the 90s. But Mark traced its genesis all the way back to a trove of stolen World War II plunder. And I was amazed at how huge this sum was and how thoroughly it had been laundered through other banks and entities, notably real estate and oil.
Do you think that these narrative structures or interlocks have been thoroughly mined to tell us a real story about things that, for example, BCCI, he was doing everything from the Vatican Bank to the Mafia. Do you think these have been properly mined?
Well, I don't think enough people have really looked at how they form one consecutive pool of money, as it were. You know, people have tended to look at the drawings separately, but really, you know, these hot funds, which includes both plundered or laundered money and more legitimate hot funds that flow in and out of countries in search of yield and some, in some cases tax advantages. How they fueled resource and real estate and other bubbles all over the world. So what I was exploring was the idea that what didn't evaporate in bad investments could continue to pool offshore and unregulated and untaxed. And in the last part of the book, I indulge in some speculation about how large that pool of money might become and what it might have gone into. For example, Glencore, which is the commodities trading platform founded by Mark Rich, who is, as I said, one of Mark's key middlemen. There's been a lot of debate in the financial press lately about Glencore being the next Lehman Brothers.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's really interesting, and it's dense material in this book as far as tracing all these relationships, which I suppose the actual interlocks would help you understand better. But I guess you were unable to get permission to reproduce any of the interlocks in the book. Why did that happen?
His dealer, one of his dealers, objected to the book.
Really?
Uh-huh. And would not allow the work to be reproduced.
Now, earlier,
there is a fair amount of it that one can inspect online, and I uh-huh. have a number of examples on my website.
Yep.
But one of the great pities is that his drawings have been broken up. Many of them have disappeared into private collections. So it's difficult to get the big picture. Now there's a computer scientist in Germany, for example, who's been working on converting all of the names in Mark's drawings to hypertext. But he told me when I interviewed him in the book that one of his biggest difficulties is that he cannot gain access to all the drawings.
So
and photograph them in a way that makes them easy to read.
So do you think some of these have gone into private hands to keep them out of the public eye, or do you think that's just a normal matter of a valuable art commodity being put into private hands? I mean, there's lots of artwork that are not seeing the light of day because they belong to somebody and they want to just only view them privately. What do you think it is, the former or the latter?
Of course, that's true. But it is possible to get special permission to see Mark's drawings at the Whitney and at the Museum of Modern Art. I did in the course of researching the book, but they're kept in storage. You know, they're not regularly shown. That's partly because their work's on paper and they're considered fragile.
Right. My guest today is Patricia Goldstone. Her book is titled Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. It's published by Counterpoint Press. Now, earlier you were talking about, you know, Mark's story is a dark story at times. It certainly ends, his life ends darkly with a suicide, and you raise questions over whether it was a suicide. What are some of the other darker aspects of his life that you probe in the book?
Well, I'm referring primarily to his death. I mean, it ends quite darkly.
Yes.
But Mark was, you know, he was actually quite a funny guy and charming and exuberant and very good socially when he wanted to be. He wasn't some brooding conspiracy theorist hiding in a dark room, not by any means. He was very gregarious and quite a shrewd player of the art game in his own way.
Yeah, he sort of had this idea about how to exhibit his work to get the biggest, bang for the buck, if you will, as far as getting the word out about him. What was his process?
Well, he kept extensive lists of journalists, of government figures, of the heads of non-governmental organizations that focus on corruption. He kept all of these in his files, and he would invite them to his openings.
Hmm.
He's good at getting the word out.
And if they see their name up there. No, everybody likes to see their name in print, right?
Well, exactly. And he used to say, every exhibition is a well-baited trap.
Well, talk about his suicide. You raised some interesting questions. You said even though his marriage had broken up, he was really on the cusp of more fame, which is something he apparently was interested in, and success, financial success. He was really on the cusp of this. And it was something he realized at the time of his death. What are some of the major questions you feel like is a part of this suicide, which was officially a suicide? He was found hanging in his apartment, no means of entry. But what are some of the questions you raise about this?
Well, his marriage had actually broken up in the mid-90s before he came to New York. He was in a relatively long-term relationship, which had problems, and he had broken up with his girlfriend a couple of months before his death, but he was quite interested in seeing other women and did so. And it's very curious. I interviewed over 80 people in the course of doing this book who had known him over the 49 years of his life, and many of them were people who lived in Williamsburg and knew him around the time of his death. But the range of opinion about whether he was depressed or not is amazing. In the book, I refer to it as a Rashomon, which is, you know, it's the famous Japanese movie about a murder rape, and everybody who is called it as a witness has a different story. That was certainly the case when I was putting these interviews together. But I actually began my research by getting hold of the police reports through a friend of mine in a homicide division in New York. I realized there were a lot of things about the reports themselves that didn't ring true. A time of death was never established, for one thing, and that's a pretty standard part of the procedure. Establishing death by hanging is a very controversial area of forensic pathology. And the police based their verdict of death by suicide, which was done in 2 days with quite a scanty investigation, on the testimony of one witness who appeared increasingly unreliable during the interview process. Then I actually tracked down the two cops who found him, and one of them, who was a rookie at the time, showed what I would call considerable signs of doubt. Then when you look at the exact nature of what's in the drawings, that could cause any number of people to want him dead. Right. Now, I don't have anything like a smoking gun, and I don't have the power to subpoena people, but certainly the weight of circumstantial evidence made me feel that at a minimum a lot more questions should have been asked at the time of his death. And the fact that they weren't still makes me queasy.
Mm. Well, it's a really interesting book into Mark Lombardi's process, the web of information that he collected and put on paper in his artwork. The name of the book is Interlock. Patricia Goldstone, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Patricia Goldstone is a journalist who has written for the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post, and her latest book is titled Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. It's published by Counterpoint Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.